Hello, everyone, and welcome to the bonus episode of The Rest is History. I'm afraid that Dominic is not with us today because he is off on holiday, but not to worry, because we have with us Theo, who, of course, is our producer. And also, Theo, you are a Frenchman, supposedly.
Producer first, Frenchman second, I think in that order these days.
But I mentioned the French aspect because, of course, we've just done a series on Paris in 1968.
Yeah.
And you were there producing for us in Paris when we kind of went round to the Sorbonne and the...
With the bin men in the background.
Exactly. Yes. So I listened to it and I thought the sound on it was incredible. You could occasionally hear a bin, but actually absolutely top production there.
Thanks. I tried to mix back in the bin noises as much as possible because I know that that's what the Wangs and Athelstans are really after, is the sound of the French bin men. And there was that drilling in the background too was a lot of fun.
Well, there were a lot of bins and drilling in Amsterdam as well, weren't there? So
There were. But yeah, I was happy with both episodes, both brilliant content. And I think it really came across that you both had a wonderful time out there recording those episodes. So a good odd laugh.
Yeah, we did. So, I mean, of course, the huge development in recording that was that Dominic decided actually he'd forgiven Paris. And not only had he forgiven Paris, but he positively wanted to go back there. So we'll be going back to do the French Revolution, hopefully, next May. So
yeah, 6-part series on the French Revolution, hopefully. We've had to, you know, maybe have a word with certain people higher up in the company saying, you know, 6 parts on French content is exactly what our listeners want to hear about. And since we only did 1 episode on it.
Exactly. I would say that of all the complaints we get about the relative balance of number of episodes to seriousness of subject, the complaint that we did 1 episode on the French Revolution, and say we've done 2 on fashion in the 60s, haven't we? We've done 4 yep. on British fascism.
2 on Oscar Wilde's.
Yep. 2 on Oscar Wilde's trial. So 1 on the French Revolution is clearly not enough. And I think it'll be brilliant. So we can go to Versailles and we can go to the site of the Bastille.
Yeah. And considering how you treated the American Revolution series with regards to the American side of the debate, I am slightly worried about how you're going to... I guess there's no English involvement in the French Revolution, really.
Well, I always... So, one of my favourite exchanges with Dominic was in the early stages of that French Revolution episode. And I said, you know, we're talking about the terror. And I said, yeah, but, you know, you can't make an omelette without breaking some eggs. And Dominic said, yeah, but they didn't make an omelette. They just threw the eggs around the kitchen.
Yeah.
So I think you know where John Bull is going to be coming from. Because Edmund Burke is his great hero. So when we went to Dublin and we had to nominate a favourite Dubliner, he nominated Edmund Burke. So
instead of our friend, well, not my friend, but Cromwell, of course. Dominic shied away from saying that on stage, didn't he?
Yeah, he wussed out on that. Because Edmund Burke, of course, wrote that brilliant essay on the terror. Actually, no, I think he wrote it before the terror, but writing about Marie Antoinette, that the age of chivalry is dead and the time was when 1,000 swords would be drawn from their scabbards in defense. Classic Daily Mail editorial.
Anyway, Tom, I feel like we are wittering already. And so
I don't
we
think
have
we're wittering
first,
at all. Well, no. I don't think we're wittering at all because I just want to stick to the French subject. And
tell
I want
me.
To ask you, as someone who is simultaneously French and a young person, were you familiar with any of this? Any of the May 68 stuff? Do the Soissons Huitard have any resonance with you?
They did, in the sense that my grandmother at home, she has this kind of wall of fame or photos of people that she finds funny or whatever. And long story short, she has photos of Michael Phelps because she's American and you know, US Olympians. And then she has this photo of a very young looking Nicolas Sarkozy, kind of fist in the air, shouting insults at some sort of riot police. And he is there during May 68.
So he's part of the racaille.
So he is part of the racaille. So the very racaille that he...
So the racaille is a scum, wouldn't it be? I guess you'd say that he then referred to rioters in 2005.
Yeah, he was in fact once one of the rioters. That's all I really understood of it. And also de Gaulle's... I mean, I studied it a bit when I was at school in France, and there was kind of always this idea of, de Gaulle kind of triumphant, and he shut down the protesters. I have to say, my school were probably pro de Gaulle and not pro the, you know.
Well, you went to a Catholic school, didn't you?
I did. So unsurprisingly, they didn't love Foucault's kind of philosophy and all the happenings.
But you mentioned Sarkozy being part of the Soissons Huitard, and then that comment on the rioters being racaille was, I think, when he was interior minister, wasn't it? And he said that they should be cleaned with a jet hose.
Yeah.
And those rioters, of course, were they weren't Marxist students or anything like that. These were people from the banlieue. And one of the things, of course, that is really striking, listening to that episode, which we recorded in May, about riots and revolutions breaking out in Nanterre, is that since we recorded that episode, another sequence of rioting has broken out following an incident in Nanterre. But that incident was the shooting by the police of a young man of Algerian descent. And it highlights the way in which actually there is no real correspondence whatsoever between 68 and the rioting that happened earlier this month.
Yeah, I mean, I feel what really came across in the episodes, and again, I was learning it as you and Dominic were going along, but it was really originally a completely kind of middle class, not even struggle. It was just, you know, these students who kind of wanted something to kick up a fuss about. And they started with the dorms, and then there was all sorts of carry on afterwards. But the workers kind of got involved, I get, in the end, but there was no sort of cohesion between both groups. And famously, even the communists, who are always dying for revolution, thought, do you know what? We actually really don't want anything to do with this one, which really says a lot, I think, about what the crowd was like.
But all those groups, the middle-class students, the workers, the communists, none of them were in any way an inspiration for what happened in France earlier this month. And it really kind of highlights the, I guess, the social and cultural changes that have happened within the urban fabric of a city like Paris.
Definitely. As we kind of said in the episodes, again, a lot of the rioting we see these days is sadly divided between the lines of kind of Paris intramuros versus, you know, the banlieue. And whereas this was, you know, where we were sat in Paris during the recording, it was, you know, super central, right next to Notre Dame.
Yes.
And that's where the protests were happening. That would never, ever happen nowadays. And the Paris police, the CRS, you know, they do their best to keep all of the violence that, you know, they're kind of engaging with outside of Paris. And to be fair, there have been some crazy incidents recently where, you know, there's mobs destroying high streets and, you know, cars being blamed.
The Gilets jaunes are more prone to bursting into Paris, aren't they?
Exactly.
So that those are the protesters from outside Paris, from the countryside, usually.
And again, the kind of confusing contingency of different groups who just basically don't like petrol price increases. But I mean, I think this discussion shows how kind of complicated French politics and society still is, in that they're still rioting very often. You know, it's every 6 months to every year, there's some sort of crazy chaos in Paris happening. And I think the 1968 one was maybe, as we said, the last one that came up on the kind of world scene, because since then it's just been kind of internal disputes over issues that aren't really relevant to a wider world, apart from when you look at multiculturalism and how immigration has shaped kind of these Western countries. And I think there's some interesting implications there.
But I think this is tremendous that we've given the French perspective on the rest of history. There was actually an article about the rest of history in L'Express by Agnès Poirier, who came on the show quite early on in the run to talk about the history of Paris, which is where Dominic first expressed his distaste for the City of Light. So Theo, we are, you know, we're getting the French perspective here on the show.
Yeah, I mean, listeners cannot see the gun that you're holding to my head currently as we record this.
Not at all. So that's Theo with your French hat on. And now with your producer's hat on. Mm-hmm. Has anything changed over the course of when you started, when you first came in and started producing? Do you feel that you're enjoying it still? I mean, you've got to say that, haven't you? Because you're talking to me. And so
every second of it. Yeah. No, nothing better.
Do you feel that, have you learned? Have you grown? Are you on a journey?
I feel like I've definitely bettered myself through this journey of working alongside both you and Dominic. No, I mean, has it changed? I think I was last on to discuss. It was after our 100 Years War series. And since then, a lot's happened. I mean, we've done our whole European tour. We've done our transatlantic tour to the US. And yeah, we got through a very busy kind of late spring, early summer period and came out the other end. So learning, I mean, I've learned to deal with your schedule and scheduling issues, Tom, I might say.
Yeah, it's a nightmare, isn't it? I'm absolutely hopeless.
I mean, you're a very, absolutely very, hopeless. Very busy man. Listeners should know that while Dominic is quite good at saying no to stuff, which I know will surprise you, Tom, on the other hand, is always keen for another adventure.
No, it's not. It's partly that, but it's also partly that I'm terrible at kind of, I don't want to say no to people, because I'm just a very weak person.
Tom is the kindest person you'll ever meet and just hates disappointing people.
It's not kindness, it's weakness. It's weak. So I'm just having to slightly butch up on that front. And also I'm just kind of hopeless with the logistics.
No.
And diaries and things.
Very harsh on yourself, Tom. Dominic will really enjoy hearing this. Obviously, as everyone knows, he listens to every single bonus episode. So Tom admitting to his failures as a member of the show will be music to his ears.
It's all part of some deep, deep game. So exactly. should we look at some questions? So Dominic will be back next week and we will be carrying on looking at some of the questions that you've been posting in. Maybe some of the bigger, deeper questions.
Yep. A few points of order before. We forgot to mention a few things, Tom. So first of all, our upcoming live stream, bit too much cricket there. Our upcoming live stream will be on August the 15th, the next one at 8 p.m. UK time. So that's for all our Wangs and Athelstans. Please join us.
That is dependent on my Wi-Fi in my Scottish estate holding up. So I'm off to my Scottish estate after I record this, actually. And the issue with that is, as I think I may have mentioned before, the Wi-Fi is terrible. So I'm hoping that will hold out.
Tom, I'm worried that listeners will think that you're always getting your schedule wrong because you're always going on holiday to your Scottish estate. I mean, I think most bonuses tend to start with you saying that you're heading up north.
But in the past, when I've been heading up north, it hasn't been on holiday. This is 2 weeks holiday. So
very much deserved. And the Athelstan quiz, again, to reiterate, is on the 21st of August at 8 p.m. UK time. And that is for all our Athelstans. If you're not an Athelstan yet, get your membership now. It's unbelievable value.
It's going to be the world's best quiz.
I mean, the value, Tom.
Just unbelievable value, and also the chance to come to a massive Athelstan party. Exactly. Later in the year. I mean, value doesn't come better than that.
Literally. So question time, Tom. We had a comment from Horatio Nelson, super fan. Again, Dominic would love to hear this when he listens back to this bonus. Just want to say I have no questions, but I'm a big fan of the Wittering. Please don't lose it. Well, Horatio Nelson, super fan. You've had 15 minutes of it already today, so I hope you're happy.
Yeah, he'll be enjoying this show so far.
So quick one for you, Tom. From Toff88, if Stuart Broad were a figure from history, who would he be?
Okay, so just a bit of explanation here for people who may have no idea who Stuart Broad is or what we were doing on Saturday.
Friday.
No, Friday, wasn't it? On Friday. So so this is about cricket. This is about the Ashes. England against Australia playing cricket. It's reaching its climax, actually, as we record this. So it's the last day of the Ashes series, which has been going on for a month or so. And Theo and I had a day together at the Oval, which is a very historic ground.
It was a historic day, Tom.
About a mile and a half from where we live. And it's a historic ground, partly because it's of all the sports grounds in England, it has the greatest sporting pedigree because it's where the very first Ashes Test match was played. It's where the idea of the Ashes was born. But it was also, I think, the place where the first FA Cup final, so that's football, was played. I think it was the site of the first international fixture between England and Scotland, which I think was rugby. Aussie Rules has been played there. So it's an incredibly historic ground, wonderful ground. But it's also the badge of Surrey, the cricket team, the county cricket team that is based there, are three ostrich feathers, which people who've listened to the episodes that we did on the Hundred Years' War will remember is originally the badge of King John of Bohemia, the blind king, who rather improbably was in charge of a large chunk of the French army at Crecy, even though he couldn't see anything.
It didn't go too well. Yep.
And who ended up being led by a page into the thick of the fighting where he died. And the legend is that Edward the Black Prince, Edward of Woodville, was given the coat of arms. Edward of Woodstock was given the coat of arms by his father, Edward III. And so the three ostrich feathers became the badge of the Prince of Wales from that point onwards. And when the Black Prince, he went on to win the Battle of Poitiers, he then went to Bordeaux, where he ruled as the Prince of Aquitaine. And he fell ill. He came back to England, and the place where he basically was based and where he endured his long illness was his palace at Kennington, which is where the Oval today is situated. So it's known as the Kennington Oval. Kennington Palace, which was the where the Black Prince lived after coming back from Aquitaine, was, I think, pulled down in the reign of Henry VIII. And he kind of, he recycled a lot of the building material. But that link between the Prince of Wales and Kennington endures. And so the Prince of Wales to this day is the landlord of the Kennington Oval. So it was Prince Charles, now King Charles, and so now it's Prince William. But the man who obtained for Surrey County Cricket Club the right to use the three ostrich feathers links us to another show that we did on Oscar Wilde. So you may remember the Earl of Rosebery.
Of course.
So the Earl of Rosebery was associated with another of the sons of the Marquess of Queensbury, who was the guy who was prosecuted by Wilde for libel and then basically brought about Wilde's downfall. But there were kind of links with the Earl of Rosebery, who was the Liberal Prime Minister as well. And Rosebery was married to a Rothschild. So very, very wealthy heiress, adored her very much, but seems to have had a weird vein of anti-Semitism, despite the fact that his wife was Jewish. So that one of his eldest son, who I think went on to become Lord Dalmainey, I think is the eldest son of the Earl of Rosebery, is called Lord Dalmainey, of course. But Rosebery felt that this eldest son looked very Jewish and so was rather hostile to him. But Lord Dalmainey went on to become both an MP and a brilliant cricketer. And he was captain of Surrey when they won the championship while also serving as an MP. So he'd go to the Oval, do his cricket stuff, and then he'd go to the House of Commons and vote on tariffs or Ireland or whatever.
Yeah.
And he was big pal with the Prince of Wales, so the future Edward VII. And he obtained from the future Edward VII, the Prince of Wales, the right for his cricket county, Surrey, to use the Prince of Wales' ostrich feathers. I can't remember how I got onto this. So, how did I get onto this?
So the answer to your question, Stuart Broad, yeah.
Okay, and I should just mention that all of this this stuff about Jews and cricket is the theme of a fabulous exhibition at Lord's. So anyone with any interest in cricket or Jewish history, or maybe both, do go and see that exhibition. But we were at the Oval, the other great cricket ground in London, and we had a great day, didn't we, Theo?
Amazing day.
We were in the pavilion. It was kind of wonderful.
Unbelievable.
And Stuart Broad is a brilliantly charismatic fast bowler. So in American terms, that means he's the pitcher.
He throws the ball very quickly.
And he is he's retiring today. So there's a lot of people who love cricket. There's a lot of emotion involved. He's very entertaining. And I've actually already answered this question on the Discord. If Stuart Broad were a figure from history, who would he be? And the answer is Stuart Broad, because Stuart Broad is a figure of immense historical significance. Who else could he be but Stuart Broad? So there we go.
Definitely. Okay, Tom. Well, we've done one question in 20 minutes so far, and it's been about cricket.
Yeah, sorry about that.
So no, not to worry. So let's keep rattling through this. Why Sigithan? I never know how to pronounce this person. What's your Hancockian out there pet theory?
I don't really have an Hancockian out there pet theory.
Okay, no Hancockian theories from Holland.
So this is Graham Hancock, who thinks that the Ark of the Covenant is in a church in Ethiopia and thinks that the Templars were involved in it and thinks that he used to think that Atlantis was buried under the ice of Antarctica, and he thinks that there was an ancient civilization that existed during the Stone Age. And
I think he's now a friend of the show.
Yes, I think he's a friend of the show because he provided inspiration for an entire episode on Atlantis.
And a lot of
he also featured in the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
So I think he does, but I personally don't believe any of it.
Me neither. It's quite a fun kind of rabbit hole to go down until you realize this is all definitely tosh. Florida. Oh,
hold on. Because I just wanted to reply to Antipodean Anne, who asked, I'm really sorry to ask such an obvious question, but I'm new to this, an Australian to boot, but what is a wang? Well, of course, I mean, wang has all kinds of significations, but...
Well, let's stick to the rest is history definition.
The rest is history definition. This derives from two episodes that we did on General Gordon, great Victorian hero who ends up being killed at Khartoum. And while he was in Woolwich, it was in Gravesend. He was in charge of the garrison at Gravesend, and all the kind of the ragamuffins out in the streets, he felt very bad for them. And so he arranged for them to be educated, to be fed, to be clothed, kind of charitable work.
Like an orphanage or something.
Traditionally, since the time of Lytton Strachey, who wrote a series of very, very bitchy biographies of four eminent Victorians, of which Gordon was one.
Mm.
There's been a kind of lurking suspicion of this, that he was up to no good, that he was a perv, whatever. I think that's unlikely. I think Gordon, I mean, he was clearly very, very sexually repressed, but who knows what he was repressing? It seems to have been very much focused on the ladies.
Okay.
But he was also a very devout evangelical Christian and felt that it was his duty to care for those who were more unfortunate. And these boys, Gordon had come back from China, where he was known as Chinese Gordon. He'd kind of cut a tremendous dash out there. And he referred to these boys as his Wangs, and Wang is Chinese for king. And they would grow up and they would go out into the world. Often, you know, Gordon would find them posts on ships or with merchants or whatever. And they would then kind of write back and he would say, ah, a letter from my one of my Wangs. And I think that that's when we were setting up the Privates Members Club. And so I can't quite remember how it was that, I don't think it came from us. I think it was from the members suggested that they call themselves the Wangs.
Yeah.
But obviously now that those Gordon episodes are a long way back in the past, I agree, it might seem a bit odd. And the Athelstans also reflects the fact that Athelstan was voted top king in our World Cup of English Kings and Queens. So that's the explanation for it.
Holly in Florida, thinking about the Library of Alexandria, I'm wondering which archives you all have visited that have left a compelling impression, and or which archives would we grieve most if we lost them today?
I haven't really visited archives because I write about the ancient world.
You just make your stuff up.
Yeah, I don't make my stuff up. But obviously the Library of Alexandria doesn't exist, so I can't go and visit it. So that's very sad. I have been to...
Surely you've been to some archives.
I've been to Herculaneum, where there's the charred remains of a vast library owned probably by Julius Caesar's father-in-law. And they are so charred that it's almost impossible to read them. But there is this enduring hope that perhaps the technology one day will be sufficient to enable those texts to be read. It seems mostly to be rather obscure Greek philosophy, so it may not be the most thrilling of subjects. But, you know, that's a kind of exciting possibility. Which archives would we grieve most if we lost today? I mean, there's no question about that. It would be the British Library.
Well, of course.
The holdings of the British Library, which are, I gather from Wikipedia, the largest in the world. I thought that it was the Library of Congress, but apparently...
Did Dominic write that Wikipedia entry, by any chance?
Well, no, it'd be me, because I'm a trustee of the British Library, so I'm very biased on this. That's partly what inspired the Library of Alexandria episode, is the fact that this is the 50th anniversary of the British Library. But the holdings of the British Library ultimately reach back much further than that. I mean, all the way to the 16th century. So basically, you know, if the British Library got wiped out, that would be terrible.
Okay, I'm keeping us rolling here because I'm aware you need to head to your estate. James has a question. Who is more important to the culture of Britain? Shakespeare, King Henry VIII, King James I, or Winston Churchill?
I think Shakespeare. And I would think that Churchill is in there because he's an icon of modern Britain, but I mean, he's a controversial icon. And I think that he is becoming less significant to the cultural self-image of Britain pretty much by the year, actually, it seems at the moment. King James I, I guess, is there in his role as the patron of the King James Bible, which is enormously influential on English as it's spoken and written. So many phrases derive from that. Henry VIII, I'm guessing, is there because of his role in making England Protestant. And that is clearly enormously seismic. But as we've discussed on this bonus episode before, I think it improbable that England and Scotland would not have become Protestant, probably. I mean, they might not have done. You can imagine contingencies and counterfactuals where that didn't happen. But particularly England was so much a part of that kind of North Sea nexus of Protestantism that sees Norway, Denmark, North Germany, the Netherlands, go Protestant. I think it's improbable that certainly Southern England wouldn't have become a hotbed of Protestantism. So Shakespeare is inimitable. Shakespeare has clearly had, of all writers, I mean, even more than the King James Bible, the profoundest influence on the shape and fabric of spoken and written English. And his plays have been by far the most influential texts on the course of not just English literature, but you might say modern European literature. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare's been an enormous influence, certainly on German. You know, there's kind of the joke that the German scholar saying, I hear the English translation of Shakespeare's not bad. Big influence on French in the 19th century, Victor Hugo.
Well, I wouldn't go that
hugely
far.
I think so, Theo.
And we're going to do a series on Shakespeare, aren't we, Tom?
We are. So we are planning to do four episodes on Shakespeare. I think we can. I think, you know, this is the perk of
private members
of being a Wang.
Yeah.
So we, in the new year, so we're going to be doing a sequel to our Rise of the Nazis series, aren't we? We're going to do The Road to the Second World War.
Well, I thought we were doing the 11th Century Clooney.
We're going to do that as well. No, so this is what we discussed at the Oval, is how to not do anything on the Nazis and just focus on 11th century monks.
Yeah.
But we're not going to do that. We're going to do four episodes on kind of, how the Nazis embed their power and the build up to the Second World War. But then we're going to do four episodes on Shakespeare. And we haven't absolutely finalized it, but kind of working theories are one on Hamlet, one on Romeo and Juliet, one on who was Shakespeare, kerfuffle. I mean, that's very Hancockian.
Was Shakespeare a woman?
Was Shakespeare Elizabeth I or Marlowe or Francis Bacon or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And one perhaps on Shakespeare's use of history, or perhaps Shakespeare's global influence or something like that. But we'll find a way of doing it. I mean, actually, if you have thoughts on if there's any particular aspect of Shakespeare that you would like us to do, then please do let us know. And Theo, I think we should stop at this point because...
You have a train to catch.
Well, actually, I mean, I have got a train to catch, but first of all, I have to go on the ABC in Australia, so the Australian news, which I'm going off to do now. So
you're too big for us these days, Tom. Everyone wants you. Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And we'll be back next week, hopefully without me, for another Rest History bonus episode.
Yeah, so we'll be back next week, Dominic and I, and we'll just be going through some more of your questions. So we will see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.